This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Can President Bush close the credibility gap on Iraq? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Faced with dwindling public support, President Bush began a public relations offensive today to convince Americans he has a strategy for the war in Iraq. In a speech and a policy paper, he talked about training Iraqi security forces, but he rejected any timetable for American troops to come home. On To the Point, what's the military reality on the ground in Iraq? What does the president mean by victory, and how does he hope to achieve it? What's the political reality here at home? On Reporter's Notebook later on, parental consent for abortion and the U.S. Supreme Court. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. President Bush began a highly touted public relations campaign today to restore public confidence in the war in Iraq. On To the Point, what does the president mean by victory, and how does he hope to achieve it? Are American troops any closer to coming home? On Reporter's Notebook, led by the new Chief Justice, John Roberts, the U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments on parental consent for abortion. First, this news update. With all the pomp due the Commander-in-Chief, President Bush spoke today at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. Part of what he said was familiar.
Some are calling for a deadline for withdrawal. Many advocating an artificial timetable for withdrawing our troops are sincere. But I believe they're sincerely wrong. Pulling our troops out before they've achieved their purpose is not a plan for victory.
The president spoke in front of a curtain with signs proclaiming plan for victory. And the White House issued a 38-page paper called National Strategy for Victory in Iraq. Peter Greer is Washington editor for the Christian Science Monitor. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Sure, anytime.
What did the president say by way of defining what it is that he means by victory?
Well, first of all, I think that simply repeating the word victory is one of the main points of the entire exercise. I mean, right now the American people is hearing the word withdrawal a lot in conjunction with Iraq. I think that the White House would really much prefer that they think of the word victory when they think of the word Iraq. I mean, that being said, to more directly answer your question, I think that they didn't really say anything new about what victory would be. They basically said we'll be there as long as it takes. And until, to a certain extent, Iraqi troops are able to stand up and take care of their own country.
He did say, did he not, that that is the goal, that Iraqi troops be able to provide security in the country. Is that in itself a definition of victory, do you think?
Well, you know, that's a good question. To a certain extent, that is a subtle change in the definition of victory, because basically what they're saying is, when the Iraqi forces are strong enough to, in our estimation, kind of fight their own battles, we'll go away, even though there are still battles to be fought. So, to a certain extent, they're defining victory as something in which we can leave a country that still has a certain level of continued violence.
So, does it appear, then, that the president is trying to pave the way for a drawdown of troops?
Some people would say that what he's really basically doing is to a certain extent agreeing with his critics in the sense of saying, well, you're right, we're never going to pacify the country, and then saying we need to have some kind of plan to get out. But he doesn't want a timetable for that withdrawal, and he wants it defined as a victory and not as a strategic retreat.
He mentioned, as we just heard, the idea of what he referred to as an arbitrary date, artificial date or timetable for withdrawal. Senator Kerry, Democrat, of course, who ran against him last year, immediately said nobody ever called for an artificial date for withdrawal. That's a straw man that the president's just trying to shoot down. What's the context there?
Well, I think that the White House has been a little quick to say that the Democrats basically want us to pull all our troops out now. That's not exactly what they've been saying. Most of them have been calling for a phased timetable that would get us out in 6 months or so, or I think as Congressman Murtha has said, you know, as soon as practical. But to a certain extent, you do have a true debate here in which the Democrats are saying we want, you know, a timetable with actual numbers and dates. The president is saying let's leave those dates and numbers out of it.
The minority leader in the House, Nancy Pelosi of San Francisco, changed her tune a bit today as well, said that she now thinks a majority of the Democratic caucus supports Congressman Murtha of Pennsylvania, who has called for an immediate withdrawal. Is that a surprise?
Well, as again I said, I don't think it's entirely fair to say that Congressman Murtha has called for a complete immediate withdrawal. As mm-hmm. I said, what he wants is to begin bringing troops home now, perhaps end that in 6 months. And again, it has the phrase, you know, practical completion of that in his resolution. But again, as I said, I think that Senator Kerry is. Let me back up a second. The one interesting thing that Bush said about timetable is he said artificial timetable. Well, why is a timetable artificial? Why can't it just be a timetable? The word artificial is just a word to denigrate that whole exercise.
So the debate really has been joined, and what we're hearing is each side trying to define the terms of it and say what the other side is saying.
That's an excellent way of summing it up.
What do we expect next from the White House? I know the president has other speeches between now and the next election in Iraq on December 15th. So what are we looking for?
Well, and this particular one, of course, focused on the Iraqi troop withdrawal. The Iraqi troop force development, and said, you know, he talked a bit about that, a measurement about that, about how Iraqi forces are now in charge of certain parts of Baghdad that were very dangerous before. In the speeches to come, he'll be focusing on other specific parts of the what they claim to be their strategy for victory. The White House hasn't said yet exactly how that will be laid out, but each speech will have a particular theme. The whole thing is, of course, leading up to the December 15th vote in Iraq for a new government.
Okay, Peter Greer, as always, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Washington editor for the Christian Science Monitor. In a moment, we'll talk more about what the president calls his plans for victory and this issue of troop development in Iraq on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Ali back with To the Point. In his speech at Annapolis today, the president emphasized the role of American troops in training Iraqi forces.
As the Iraqi forces gain experience and the political process advances, we will be able to decrease our troop levels in Iraq without losing our capability to defeat the terrorists.
Again, the president speaking today at Annapolis. Bradley Graham is military correspondent for The Washington Post. Bradley, thanks a lot for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Is this a shift on the president's part from focusing on American troops and their role in providing security for Iraq to very specifically talking about their role in training Iraqi troops and talking more about the targeting of the most dangerous targets, I guess is the way the president put it?
Yeah. Well, this shift actually came at the beginning of this year when the mission of U.S. forces was formally redefined by the commanders in Iraq to include more of a focus on the training of Iraqi forces, making the fight against the insurgency still an objective, but putting more emphasis on bringing the Iraqi forces along.
The president today went into more detail than we've heard before on the state of the Iraqi forces and their readiness to take over and fight on their own. How much of it sounded new to you at the Pentagon?
None of it was really new. It was interesting, though, to hear him trace what has been a rather rocky path that the U.S. has encountered here in trying to figure out how to train the Iraqi forces. The president ran through how initially the focus had been on training a military that would be that would concentrate on defending the country against external threats, and an Iraqi civil defense corps that would be focused on security inside Iraq's borders. This strategy didn't get very far and changed last year with the Civil Defense Corps folded into the Army, and the Army itself was directed more towards the insurgency within Iraq. And basically what happened was the U.S. military lost about a year in developing the Iraqi military and really only got set on its current strategy in the summer of 2004. And the president retraced this. It was interesting to hear him acknowledge that the first months after the invasion, the U.S. Wasn't really on the track that it is now in developing Iraqi forces. Anyway, they are now, the White House, the Pentagon, they are now very convinced that they are on the right path, that you heard the president give the numbers for how many Iraqi forces there are, 212,000, and growing, although those figures do mask how many are actually capable right now of taking the lead in the fight. About a third of the roughly 120 military and special police battalions are at this point actually capable of operating alongside U.S. forces and taking the lead in these counterinsurgency operations. But that still is quite a substantial jump over just 6 months ago.
Did the president give any real indication of when he thinks there might be a significant drawdown of American troops?
He wants to stay away from a timetable. He doesn't want to commit when numbers may begin to come down or by what amounts. But a number of administration officials and military commanders have been saying in recent days that the numbers will very likely start to come down early next year, and there are a number of plans that have been drawn up to begin to bring them down. At the same time, the officials and commanders caution against expecting that the U.S. will be done with Iraq within a year or two. The expectation is that a good number of U.S. forces may be required in Iraq for some years to come to help support these Iraqi security forces.
Bradley Graham, again, military correspondent for The Washington Post. William Arkin is military affairs analyst for NBC and The Washington Post Online. He's also a blogger and a former Army intelligence expert. William Arkin, always good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
You have been in favor of an immediate withdrawal of American troops. The president made a lengthy speech today. He's gotten out this 38-page plan for victory in Iraq. Has he said anything that causes you to change your mind?
Well, I read the 39-page strategy for victory more closely, and I was certainly went into it with an open mind to think, what is it that the president is doing as part of his offensive here that is going to counter the voices like Congressman Murtha, who have been calling for a withdrawal. I didn't find very much, but I did find one curious and interesting articulation of American strategy. We've talked already on this show today, Warren, about building up the Iraqi military and security forces, and certainly this is a significant key element of the American overall strategy. But on the military side, it's hard to put your fingers around what is it that the American military is trying to do in Iraq. And there's one line in which they describe a combination of rejectionists, Saddamists, and terrorists as the enemy. And I'm not going to quibble with whether that's an accurate description, but they say exploiting differences within the enemy is a key element of our strategy. Which is to say that each of those groups, rejectionists, Saddamists, and terrorists, have what the strategy says is incompatible long-term goals. And so it says exploiting these differences within the enemy, these incompatible long-term goals for Iraq, is a key element of our strategy. Well, to tell you the truth, Warren, that's the first time I've really heard this articulation of what it is that the American commanders are trying to do. When you go out in combat, you know, it's good to say when you start a chess game, my strategy is to win. Well, hey, that's a great strategy. But when you could actually say, hey, my strategy is to utilize this particular offensive or defensive in trying to win, then you get a better sense of what it is we're trying to do on a day-to-day basis. And I see in this, first of all, an interesting articulation, creating divisions and problems between these three disparate groups, if in fact they exist. But I also see a danger, which is that in theory, if we're successful in our strategy of exploiting differences between these three groups, we're also successful in creating the seeds for greater civil war, for greater sectarian and religious differences within the country. We are pursuing a military strategy that is accentuating some of the problems which exist in Iraq. So if we are unsuccessful in the pursuit of this strategy, we could end up with the very nightmare that the administration says that it's trying to avoid by not withdrawing.
William Arkin, military affairs analyst for NBC and Washington Post online columnist. Those differences, the rejectionists are, according to the victory statement that I, as I understand it, people who reject the idea of democracy, Saddamists, as you mentioned, who are supporters, of course, of Saddam Hussein and presumably Sunnis as well, and terrorists defined as the smallest but the most dangerous of the various elements of the insurgency. Let me introduce Dr. Dan Gouray. He's vice president at the Lexington Institute, which is a defense think tank in Washington, and formerly was director of the Pentagon's Office of Strategic Competitiveness. That was back in the first Bush administration. Dr. Gouray, always good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much.
You, too, of course, have read the strategy for victory. What do you say to what Bill Arkin suggests, that if it is successful, as he's just outlined the exploitation of the differences, it could be exacerbating the problems of Iraq?
No, I think quite the opposite is the case. And in fact, I'm not sure how you could make it any worse among those three groups. That is, you've got three groups, all of whom are opposed to not just U.S. presence, but democratization, any government that is put in under the current circumstances, be it Shia, be it Sunni, as long as it's not Saddam or something else to the degree. And so if one splits among those groups, one is splitting among minorities of a minority, that is, of the Sunnis or of foreign Arabs. And as a result, I don't see how that creates a problem. If this was to set Shia against Sunni, now then that could lead to a civil war, but that's clearly not what the document is about. And in fact, it goes to great lengths to try and argue for, in its political track, inclusion, a government that deals with its minority issues. And it raises, by the way, some of the concerns that if not Bill raised, some of the general concerns that have been raised about pluralism and factionalism and the need to overcome that before you get a stable government. So I don't see it.
So do you think that is then a coherent strategy for a victory? And do you understand, to go back to the very first question of this program, what victory means to the president?
Yeah, victory basically means, as he puts it out, sort of a stable government that is at least representative, and we will call it modern in its character, so minority rights and all the rest, a government that can defend itself, a government that is capable of putting the final nails in the coffin of the terrorists, defending its own borders, and that can manage a return to some kind of economic normalcy and even economic development. I mean, I think it's fairly straightforward, and by the way, not that different than what the administration has been saying for the past year plus.
Dr. Dan Gouray at the Lexington Institute. Back to Bill Arkin with NBC and the Washington Post. What do you say to what we have just heard? And is the idea of victory as a stable government just described by Dan Gouray one that is achievable and is leaving American troops there, at least for the foreseeable future, the way to do it?
Well, I certainly agree with Dan that this is not a new articulation of what their strategic objective is, the geostrategic objective, a moderate, stable government that is able to secure its own country. That is not a new articulation. The problem is, can you get to that point with 150 50 to 160,000 American military forces on the ground, and more importantly, with an American hidden hand essentially controlling what happens in this country. I don't think so, which is why I'm in favor of reducing the size of U.S. forces and eventually withdrawing them. But it's a gamble. It's a gamble that's saying that we have enough faith in the Iraqi governmental process and in Iraqis to secure their own future to be able to balance this corrosive element of the American military presence with our strategic objective of having Iraqis be a moderate, stable government. My response to Dan's point about the question relating to whether or not we are exacerbating the problems is that what we are doing in laying out this very nice, comfortable three groups of the enemy, rejectionists, Saddamists, and terrorists, is we're ignoring a lot of Iraqis, common Iraqis, of all stripes, who are essentially provoked to take up arms because of the American military occupation there. They're not particularly interested in the return of Saddam. They certainly don't support the goals of al-Qaeda terrorists and Islamic jihadists, and they're not necessarily even rejecting the notion of democracy. What they are rejecting is the American military presence, and by ignoring that element of the insurgency, by ignoring the common Iraqis who went to Amman, Jordan, just a few weeks ago and blew up three hotels, we are at the same time ignoring okay. the potential divisions which exist in Iraqi society.
Dr. Gouray, quickly, if you can, Senator Kerry said today the main thing that he thinks the president had ignored is the information he's getting from his own military people, and he mentioned as General Casey in this context, to the effect that it is the presence of American troops there that's the most, that this thing is doing the most to stimulate the insurgency, as Bill Arkin is saying. Your response?
Yeah, I don't see that to be the case. And in fact, we can distinguish between those Iraqis who are perhaps upset about the American presence and may even participate in low-level efforts at anti-American actions, including military actions, and those that are the hardcore, have the money, have the training, have access to outside resources and the like, and who, in a sense, are the heart and soul of it. You get rid of them, and you will reduce the insurgency. Secondly, you get rid of them, you will reduce the American presence and address the concern that Bill has cited about everyday Iraqis. But let's also be clear that the majority of everyday Iraqis, Shia, Kurds, and even a fair number of the Sunnis, are not reacting the way that some of these others are. And so you have a very large majority who don't seem to mind the U.S. presence nearly as much as a minority of the Sunnis do. And that has to be taken into account before we start saying it's us versus the Iraqis.
Okay. A lot of things to debate, much to agree and disagree on, as we have heard. Dr. Dan Gouray, Vice President of the Lexington Institute, to Bill Arkin with NBC and The Washington Post. Thanks both of you for being with us. We're going to be back in just a moment, continue this conversation about the president's speech today. On Reporter's Notebook, the U.S. Supreme Court and parental consent for abortion. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from The Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Ali back with To the Point. Once again, talking about the president's speech today at Annapolis, Maryland, with the polls showing a public support dwindling for the war in Iraq, standing as he did in front of slogans saying, plan for victory. At the same time, the White House was issuing a 38-page paper called National Strategy for Victory in Iraq. All this, of course, designed to try to bolster American support for what's going on in Iraq. Patrick Clausen is Deputy Director for Research at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. That is a think tank in Washington, very much associated with the current administration. He is also senior editor of Middle East Quarterly. And Patrick Clausen, delighted to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Do you think that the speech and the pamphlet or the paper that we have seen today have changed in any substantial way of the debate that's going on in Washington about when we should withdraw and under what circumstances?
The administration is stepping forward with a clearer and more detailed explanation of the strategy, which in fact it's been following for the last year and a half. And that's likely to affect the debate by making clear how much the administration agrees with someone like Senator Biden, with the plan that he laid out in an op-ed the other day that he saw as an alternative to administration strategy. White House reacted to that with a detailed argument that said that, in fact, what Biden's proposing is just what Bush has been trying to do. And Biden's rejoinder was, huh, exactly what is your strategy? Well, that's what this document and this speech is meant to start doing, is laying out more clearly what is the U.S. strategy.
In what way is it similar to what Senator Biden has been saying? To what extent do you think the president has co-opted other Democratic critics?
Well, actually, I think that about a year and a half ago, the U.S. adopted much more modest objectives in Iraq. Rather than trying to make Iraq the model for the region, the U.S. accepted that Iraq, in fact, was going to be a weak and fragile society for a long time to come. And rather than expecting that the United States would be able to establish a secure order in Iraq by the time the U.S. Forces left in large numbers, the U.S. recognized that this was an insurgency that was going to have to be defeated by the locals, that only when the local Iraqis are out there fighting and winning against the Iraqi insurgents will the insurgents understand that indeed they're losing, because so long as it's the U.S. troops that are doing the fighting against them, the insurgents can expect that they can outweigh the Americans. And therefore, the focus is on training Iraqi forces and not on accomplishing the military tasks ourselves. That really has been what we've been doing for the last year and a half, and what a number of critics have every reason to complain that perhaps it hasn't been done as well as it might be, but that is the strategy that the administration's had for a while.
Does that mean, then, that it would be possible to withdraw American troops sooner than if, in fact, your goal were still the idea of making Iraq this democratic model for the entire region?
Well, the ideal of making Iraq a democratic model and of establishing order before we left was just simply unattainable, and that even had the United States committed hundreds of thousands of troops for decades, we couldn't have achieved it, because our presence was having a nationalist reaction that was creating this nationalist reaction against us. And so, therefore, it was important that we show that we aren't planning to be there as a colonial power and stay. And only more modest objectives were realizable, and that, I think, is what the administration saw after the events in Najaf and Fallujah in April in 2004, where there were simultaneous uprisings among some Shia elements and Sunni elements. This was a real shock, and that's what led to this reformulated position.
Patrick Lawson, Deputy Director of Research at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Steve Clemens is Senior Fellow and Director of the American New Foundation. He's also publisher of a political blog called the WashingtonNote.com. Steve Clemens, good to have you back with us.
It's always great to be with you, Warren.
Is what we have just heard from Patrick Clawson, and is what the president's doing today, a clarification of policy, as he suggested, that's been in effect for a year and a half, or is it something new?
Well, Patrick is a friend, but I see it a bit differently than he does. I think he's giving us a glasses half full sort of interpretation of George Bush's speech today. I think what Bush was doing is engaging in a kind of sleight of hand in what he was trying to achieve. He's obviously responding to the Murthas and to the Bidens and even to the people in his own party like Chuck Hagel and John McCain, trying to demonstrate that there is actually a strategic roadmap in place. I don't think that what the president released today or what he made comments solves the mathematical realities that Joe Biden raised in his op-ed last weekend, in which he said that it is impossible to sustain 150,000 troops through this next year in Iraq if we're going to maintain current troop levels, given ground conditions, if we don't make major structural changes in the way we deploy U.S. military and National Guardsmen to Iraq. And so what George Bush has done is he's sort of wrapped our mission and reasserted the mission, the notion of building civil society and a free society and, you know, delivering liberty to the Iraqis. And that's not new. What he did do, which is dramatically different, is he engaged in a kind of grade inflation about the assessment of setting up Iraqi domestic security troops and forces. In many senses, George Bush's speech was a direct response, a counter response to Jim Fallows' very powerful cover story this month in the Atlantic Monthly that said that, you know, we are really failing miserably to set up a capable domestic Iraq security force. And what George Bush did is says, no, that's wrong. We're doing it. We've got great success. So while George Bush is trying to say that we're not cutting and running, at the same time, he's created a way out of Iraq should we need it in 2006 that is simply saying that these Iraq troops are in fact coming together more quickly than people are giving them credit for. So I think it's a test that you can test empirically. Jim Fallows says no way, and George Bush is asserting that we've got that there really is a lot of strength there that many of us don't see.
Steve Clemens with the New America Foundation. I think I inverted the words in your title a moment ago, and I apologize for that. Back
Not
to
at
Patrick
all.
Lawson with the Washington Institute. You said, in fact, that the president's trying to indicate he agrees with Senator Biden that you can't sustain the 150,000 troops unless you deploy them differently. Are there plans for some sort of change in the way they're deployed?
Well, as Iraqi forces become more capable at light infantry tasks, which is what's been happening, and Jim Fallows is absolutely right that the Iraqi army is not capable of operating fully on its own, and that's why the president is proposing that we continue to stay while we train the Iraqi forces. What the Iraqi forces are capable of doing now is functioning pretty well as individual soldiers and increasingly in small units. And so what we have to, the U.S. forces are doing is working with the Iraqis, and so that we have changed deployment quite a bit in order to go into combat operations side by side with the Iraqis and giving more and more responsibilities to the Iraqis. Over the course of this coming year, I suspect that we're going to see many more situations in which the Iraqi forces operate in combat with just U.S. support rather than side by side with U.S. forces. And the U.S. will be providing more and more the logistics services, but not the combat side of things.
When you say support, would that involve more use of air power than has been the case in recent months?
The U.S. has been using quite a lot of air power in the Iraqi confrontation, which is why the insurgents have not been able to mount many ambushes or ground operations. They depend upon suicide bombers and these bombs, these improvised explosive devices, and the occasional sniper. There's not really any ambushes or any kind of conventional sort of combat operations of the sort that insurgents engaged in Vietnam. And that's because of our dominance of the air and the use of the air power so effectively for close ground support. We're going to want to find a way in which we can continue to do that as the Iraqis take over the responsibility for the ground combat. Because working so closely together, the air and ground forces, is a very complicated skill, and it's going to be hard for us to bring the Iraqi forces up to speed.
Steve Clemens, the president saying and the victory statement or the strategy for victory, the 38-page pamphlet, says it's going to take time and patience for all this to occur. How much time do you think the administration has? How much patience is there right now, not just in Washington on the part of the Democrats, but on the part of the country?
If the president had released this document 2 years ago, Patrick talked about a year and a half ago, but say they had made this a more transparent exercise 2 years ago and had talked more honestly, I think, about the pitfalls of trying to do what we're doing, I think there'd be a lot more patience. The problem is, you know, we've surpassed we've surpassed two sort of marks. One is we're well past the number of 2,000 Americans dead, and while that doesn't compare anywhere near the number of casualties we've sustained in past wars, it does seem to be a sort of magic number in terms of the minds of many Americans. And we've been at this for 4 years since 9/11, and many people are thinking back and said, "Wow, in World War II, we fought two wars on different continents. We assembled and created and dropped the atomic bomb. We reordered our society in many ways. What have we really achieved in the 4 years since 9/11?" And people are coming back and saying, "We haven't done very well at achieving our objectives there." And patience is growing thin. And you have on top of it a convergence of some real problems, where the president's rhetoric today was as bold and as expansive as it has been at any time. And it's a vast commitment that he's making in terms of delivering a free society in Iraq, which on one level I admire. On another level, you look at the numbers, you look at the mistakes have been made over the last 2.5 years, and you say to myself, you know, this is a little bit late to be coming at this, and he's asking for a staying power and patience from the American public that I think they're not.
Right.
There's a rhetoric of withdrawal in both the Republican Party and Democratic Party that has evolved, and I think the president is out of line with both parties right now.
All right. Apparently, again, this the first in several speeches the president plans to make between now and the vote in Iraq on December 15th. We'll, of course, see what happens next, what gets emphasized next. Meantime, thanks to both of you, Steve Clements with the New America Foundation and Patrick Claussen with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
Thank you, Warren. Thank you.
I have one final guest on this subject, and that is Shibley Tahami. He is Anwar Sadat, professor for peace and development at the University of Maryland and senior fellow at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institute, author of The Stakes, America in the Middle East. And, Professor, always good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you.
We just heard that in the strategy for victory, as elucidated today in greater detail than we've seen it before, what we're seeing is a backing away from the idea that Iraq's going to be a model for the region, some sort of a democracy that others could be like, and rather, in the words of Patrick Claussen, be a somewhat weak and fragile society. I'm just interested in your perspective and what you think the perspective is of people in the Middle East. Is this a change in the perception of what it is America is trying to do?
Well, I think it's just more acknowledging reality. Frankly, when you ask people in the Arab world, as I do, I just did a new survey that I'm going to be releasing on Friday. When you ask people in the Arab world, do you believe that Iraqis are better off or worse off than they were before the Iraq war, majority say they think they're worse off than mm-hmm. they were before the war. When you ask them, is there more democracy or less democracy in the Middle East since the Iraq war, majority say there is less democracy. When you ask them if they believe that the United States' objective includes democracy, only a few, very small minorities say yes. So I don't think there's been any a question that the Middle East has not seen democracy as an American objective, have not seen an inspiration model in Iraq. They've seen it actually rather as a frightening model in some ways used by authoritarian leaders who said, you want that anarchy out there in Iraq where your children cannot be sure that they can make it to school in the morning, or would you rather have the stability that I'm giving you? And so in that sense, I think it's just acknowledging reality. It is acknowledging the fact that Iraq has not been, is not likely to be in the foreseeable future, a model, and therefore limit the objectives.
What about the votes that we have seen so far, people holding up their fingers with the marks on them and so on, and the vote we're expected to see on December 15th with even apparently Sunni leaders now saying they want to participate in that?
First of all, there's no question in my mind that many Iraqis are better off today than they were. The Sunnis are worse off, and they know and they see themselves as worse off, and probably most Shia and most Kurds think they're better off. So Iraqis themselves have a divided view, and particularly when you've been ruled by an authoritarian leader who's been ruthless like Saddam. The question is whether that adds up to a democracy. I mean, you have segments of public that are benefiting, and in some cases maybe even majorities. Clearly that's not democracy. I mean, democracy is about the protection of everyone, including minorities. And we look at the state, and we talk here in this particular case, look, we're enlarging and training Iraqi forces. Even if that succeeds, and there's doubt, obviously, that it is really succeeding as much as the president has been saying, but let's assume it does succeed. If you look at the reality of what's actually taken place, those are not exactly forces that are defending the state and the integrity of the state as such, because by and large, most of the recruits are coming from the Shia and the Kurdish areas, and they're not including largely Sunni areas, and they're seen to be sectarian in the loyalties, and as you know, even former Prime Minister Alawi has made the stunning accusation in the past week that many of those forces have been responsible for death squads against Sunnis, reminiscent of Saddam's days. So I think even if they succeed, what might happen is, in fact, change the balance of power on the ground along sectarian lines rather than necessarily lead to an establishment even of a stable and democratic state. So that is the reality that we have to contend with, that we, in fact, the structure of power, the constitution itself, the reality on the ground, is reinforcing sectarianism, but shifting the balance of power within that sectarian society.
What do you think we're going to see in the election on December 15th, or is there just any way at this point to try to predict who might come out the winners?
It's hard to know. And obviously, I think that if you look at the sort of the powers to be in Iraq today, I would argue that it's still largely Ayatollah Sistani in the Shia community, who is essentially empowering those who win and lose in the Shia area. And to the extent the Shias are a majority, that remains the most potent political force. And so the outcome in part is going to be dependent on that. There's been also a lot of disaffection with the existing government, even though it was backed by many Shia because of its failure to deliver on the ground. I think the experiment is likely to have some benefits, obviously, for Iraqis and move forward at some level, but it's unlikely, in my judgment, to gain the trust of the Sunni community. And in the end, that's going to be the most difficult challenge.
As we heard earlier, the president, in his strategy for victory, is dividing the what he calls the enemy between those, he says, who are rejectionist, rejecting a democracy, those who are still supportive of Saddam, and those who are terrorists, the latter being the smaller but the most dangerous of those three. He's also saying that if the United States fails, to use his term, in Iraq, then it will become a haven for international terrorists and a threat to the United States. Do you buy that?
Well, first of all, let's have a little bit of reality check. Iraq was not a haven for international terrorists before. It was a haven for a ruthless dictator who obviously is good that he's been removed. But it was not a haven for al-Qaeda, which is obviously the most threatening type of terrorism because it does aim to change the political order because, as the president actually correctly said, it's hard to reconcile yourself to their aims and because, in fact, they do seek in the end to confront the United States. They are now. It hasn't been before. But I disagree profoundly with the notion that the prospect of al-Qaeda taking over is high. I don't think it is. In fact, I'm not even sure that they really believe that they can take over. I think if you look at their strategy, they thrive where there is anarchy because it's hard to get at them, it's hard to deter them, it's hard to control them, it's hard to get at them where there is anarchy. That's why they've had the strategy of increasing sectarian conflict by confronting the Shia. And in fact, most of the people in the Middle East, most of the Arabs, do not agree with their objective of an Islamic State. In my survey, I ask a particular question. I ask them, what aspect of al-Qaeda do you sympathize with most? It's very critical because you have to think about what it is that those who sympathize, if at all, what is it they sympathize with? And I give them a number of choices. Only 5% or 6%, somewhere around 6%, say it is their aim of establishing an Islamic State. Only 7% agree with their methods. The largest number of people say it is the fact that they stand up to the U.S. and the fact that they seem to speak for Islamic cause.
Okay.
It's an anti-American position. It's not a pro-Al-Qaeda position. And so we have it the reverse. It's not that people are supporting Al-Qaeda for what they are, but people want to see the U.S. defeated. And that, I think, that's the notion that we're not grasping. Because of their opposition to our perceived objectives, to what we did in Iraq, people want to see the U.S. fail even more than they want to see Iraq succeed. And that is the problem.
All right. Well, thank you so much, as always, for being with us.
My pleasure.
Shibli Talhami, the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. We'll, of course, come back, talk more about all of these issues in days to come. Meantime, at his recent confirmation hearings, the U.S. Supreme Court's new Chief Justice John Roberts refused to say much about his views on abortion. Today, with Roberts in charge, the court heard his first abortion rights case in 5 years. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Werman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. 43 states now have laws requiring parental notification for teenage abortions. All of them have exceptions when a pregnant girl's life is in danger. Most also provide for medical emergencies. New Hampshire's law, though, does not allow for those non-life-threatening situations. That's one of the issues raised in arguments today. Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor, legal correspondent for the online magazine Slate.com and a contributor to NPR's Day to Day program. Dahlia, good to have you back with us.
Hi, Warren.
Any hints today from the new Chief Justice about how he might go on this case?
Oh, yeah. He was pretty clear. You know, there was a sort of second issue in this case that's quite technical, but the court talked about that, I would say, significantly more than the sort of merits of parental notification laws. And that issue has to do with, traditionally, when the court finds that in a lot of situations an abortion law is unconstitutional, it will strike down the law in its entirety. That's called a facial challenge. Essentially, the court says this whole statute is unconstitutional on its face. The question today, and it was the sort of second question, the technical question, was whether those facial challenges really are a good thing. Essentially, what the state of New Hampshire was arguing was, look, even if in a tiny, tiny, narrow margin of cases, we have a situation where the health of the mother is implicated and the doctor doesn't have time to get parental consent and he can't get a judicial bypass and blah, 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 and therefore the statute is unconstitutional, are you really going to strike down an entire parental notification statute because of a few small minority of unconstitutional applications? So it's a little bit hard to sort of wrap your head around the implications of that, but what it essentially means is that going forward, if the court were to agree with that analysis, then you could never again say, for instance, oh, this partial birth abortion statute is unconstitutional because in some cases these are medically necessary. You would have to bring case by case complaints against the court, and women would have to essentially challenge them one by one as applied to themselves only.
So that doesn't then suggest that you could, on a sort of blanket basis, order that the law provide for the medical emergencies? I suppose that would be legislating from the bench.
Exactly, Warren. And that was sort of one of the problems that was quite clear today, was that those justices who are traditionally sort of moderate on these cases, specifically Sandra Day O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy, were showing a real inclination to sort of say, look, we just want to narrow this statute so that it does have an exception, a health exception, but we're not willing to see the whole thing go on the junk heap. And so the court was really struggling with what to do with that, and John Roberts, the Chief Justice, was quite clear that he felt that the remedy was for doctors to bring what he kept calling a pre-enforcement as-applied challenge, which is sort of technical legal language for saying that this narrow class of doctors who thought the law was unconstitutionally applied to them should come to court and challenge it as applied to them. But he was not going to countenance the idea of jettisoning the entire will of the New Hampshire legislature based on a tiny, narrow class. Again, this was their language, narrow, narrow, narrow. We heard a lot today of cases in which it might be unconstitutional.
Not so narrow if you're the woman whose health is at risk and you have to wait 48 hours after the parent has been notified. And as you indicated, there's no judge around to provide an exception. How would those people be dealt with if the court ruled in this very narrow way?
Well, there was no great answer from New Hampshire on that. I mean, they feel that the statute provides for 24-hour-a-day access to a judge who can bypass, the consent requirement in emergency situations. But again, you know, the Planned Parenthood advocate was saying that's simply not true. If you come into the emergency room at 2 a.m. on a Saturday morning, there's no way to get access to a court. And more importantly, I think they argued, do you really want your doctor to be standing there, with one hand on your, liver trying to, protect your health and the other hand on the telephone trying to get an emergency judicial waiver? I mean, this really interposes the state between a doctor and his or her best judgment about what a patient needs. So I don't think there was a great answer for that. In some sense, I felt like New Hampshire almost conceded that there wasn't a great answer for that, but their argument was this sort of larger technical argument, don't junk the statute based on a handful of cases like that.
Again, we're talking with Dahlia Lithwick, editor and legal correspondent at Slate.com and correspondent for the day-to-day program. So what conceivable ruling might come out of the court if, for example, they went the way that Chief Justice Roberts seemed, as you indicated, to want to go?
Well, it looks as though, again, the court is really struggling with how to sort of narrow this. I will say that the sort of traditional liberal judges, the justices who were a majority in that Casey decision of 1992, looked like they were more or less willing to say, no, if this statute does not have a health exception for the mother, it's flat out unconstitutional. We said that in Stanberg versus Carhart, the partial birth abortion case. We said that in Casey in 1992. It's just unconstitutional. The question is, do you have, the fifth and sixth votes for that? And it's not clear that you do. On the one hand, O'Connor, I think, and I indicated this, seemed to be wanting to see this statute narrowed somehow or reversing it as unconstitutional to be on a much narrower basis. So I'm not sure we had her vote today. And again, her vote probably won't count anyhow if she's not sitting on the court when this case comes down. If Sammy Alito is sitting on this case, which is most likely, the court may have to hear it again. I think more importantly, Anthony Kennedy, who was that crucial sixth vote in Casey on the sort of pro-choice side, again, did not seem to be sympathetic today to those claims that the entire statute should come tumbling down. So it looked to me as though we don't have the majority that we had in Casey still sitting on the bench today. And more importantly, I think that the court seemed to just signal a real reluctance to allow these facial challenges to continue to go forward. It looked as though they were saying, let's figure out a way to get this health exception built in one way or another, but we're not going to get rid of the entire statute because it doesn't have that.
All right. A lot to be read into the arguments today and the questions by the justices. And thanks, as always, for your assessment of what's going on. Good to have you with us.
It's my pleasure, Warren.
Dahlia Lithwick with Slate and Day to Day. Today's program produced by Sharon Rimbaum with Ileana Justice, Francis Anderton, Karen Radziner, Jonah King, and Christian Bordahl. Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point.
KRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.